trail. Did you know this? In Idaho, you know, you could go straight, you get to Oregon or Washington, and you became a settler. Or you could go left and go over to Sierra Nevada and go to the gold rush. So the gamblers went left and the others became Oregonians. That's why you hear this anecdote in Oregon. But so there seems to be some sort of, not genetic obviously, but cultural acceptance of the boom-bust cycle. But I just didn't want to begin and end with booms and busts, including the recession, because as I said, that affects everyone. The quote by Warren Buffett was in a sense more interesting. Have we been stripping in California gradually to discover us less dressed with each tide going out and now in fact stark naked? And I think that's sort of one of the metaphors or images I ran with. And I went in search for that, the causes of the sort of the stripping, if you will. How did we get naked? Or the, what made us dysfunctional permanently, even aside from the ups and downs in the economy about which we can really not do much? And in other words, dysfunction is really an inability to respond to problems, external shocks like a recession. And that's what we seem to have. Symptoms of it are these chronic budget problems. A sort of summary factoid of it might be that during Jerry Brown's first term, the state had a triple A rating. This sort of a summary into three letters of various things going well, and now it has an A minus rating, which is a negative superlative. It's the worst among all 50. So that's interesting. It's not just the largest, the most populous, the most diverse. There's all these superlatives. It also is, considered the worst credit risk. So what could have caused it? And then I went in search of that, and you've by now been able to tell, I came at this with the eyes of an outsider, even though I've now lived here for quite a few years, but I came from Hong Kong before that, from London, and it got more confusing the longer you go back. But the first, now I tried to remember what did I first think was exotic about California when I came from Asia? Because I did find California exotic coming from Asia, and I found that ironic, in fact, because I was in these wet markets in Thailand, and then I thought that was normal by the time I left Asia. But when I came here, I thought it was interesting. Everyone seems to have bumper stickers. So everyone proclaims his or her opinion in three words, two words, sometimes one, with enormous confidence. And to the person behind you in traffic, that happens to some extent. Europe follows California with some delay, but that doesn't happen to that extent anywhere. And the other thing, there are many other things, of course, but these very thick and frequent ballot pamphlets that showed up. What could that be about? Because I assure you, that doesn't happen anywhere else either. And since we are at the World Affairs Council, let me just insert here that actually, technically, that's half wrong, because the ballot measures are initiatives, and this room, I expect you know the nomenclature of it, but let's just briefly stop, because this will be about direct democracy in a moment, about definitions. Direct democracy is three things: initiatives, referendums, and recalls. And you have, one or two or all three of these tools in quite a number of countries, and in fact, it's spreading. It's a bit of a fad or a fashion at the moment. In fact, the European Union just adopted the initiative process for the first time at a supranational level. So this year, so as of next year, you could, in theory, electronically, online, everything with the complex formula from the, collect signatures from the various nations to put an initiative. So it's interesting. It's actually, there's a, it fits a certain zeitgeist, direct democracy in principle. And the gold standard is, as it always has been, in Switzerland, which is where California imported these tools from. And also, I noticed very few Californians seem to know that, which is interesting. Just to say that, yes, direct democracy exists in many countries and in 24 states. However, it still is exotic to show up here and find this. Not just the pamphlets, the voter guide, but the attack ads and the people with the signs, yes on insert number, no on, on the streets. The circus, all of this, was very, since I'm a journalist, delightful. You know, you want a little bit of craziness to get interested in something. But then I forgot about it, and I rediscovered it when I looked into, as I said, what could have made us dysfunctional here. And I want to tell you a little bit, I mean, I'm picking now from the report you have, about the parts of your direct democracy that you might not have thought about so much, which is the history, going only about 2,000 years back, of the process, and then the international context of it, with while keeping sort of in the back of our mind, is there something unusual, indeed unique about it? And I think you'll see the answer is yes, because even though the process is in lots of places, it is unique here. And how did it become so? Was it always this way, or did it become roughly 30 years ago start becoming this way? And I think that's what happened. And then the other question to keep in the mind of, in the back of your mind as I talk, is that the thing to single out, the factor of all the other possible factors we could single out that might have made this state so dysfunctional? Because that's what, in effect, is my impression. Now, so let me back up a little bit and tell you about what I think. I'm a history buff, so please bear with me. I hope you also get excited about it, about the really interesting history of this. The word democracy is a Greek word, and demos means people, kratia means power or rule, so it's people power, as they actually used the term in the Philippines, but it means people power or people rule. And it's Greek because they first did it, and in fact, the only time they really totally did it in Athens, Pericles, during Periclean Athens. At that time, the Athenians had no judiciary, no executive, it was just the demos. And you are aware, of course, that as our founding fathers had slaves, they had slaves, and women weren't allowed. In fact, it was so small that all the citizens in the assembly governing themselves met on one rock face physically. So in Athens, they had this democracy, and they were very proud of it. However, it really didn't, it's interesting that the Greek thinkers, starting with Socrates, whom this direct democracy condemned to death, but lots of others, including his student Plato, and then that student's student Aristotle, concluded that this was not the way to have freedom, because it was, in effect, mob rule, and it was volatile and in self-destructed. So thinkers, starting with Aristotle, and then Greek thinkers like Polybius, they said the way to have freedom is to do it differently. And that Aristotle pointed towards Carthage, but then Polybius, living a bit later, pointed towards Rome, which gave us another word, which is the word republic. And that's res publica in Latin, which is a public thing. It's actually, so democracy for most of history meant direct democracy. And republic for most of history meant representative democracy, because that's what the Romans had. They had, in effect, a very rudimentary sense of our checks and balances, a mixture of an abstract concept of monarchy. They had two consuls, just for 1 year, elected, and they could veto each other. But they had a strong executive, unlike Athens. And they had a Senate, which was the equivalent of an aristocracy, a filter, as you were, of the mob. And then they had the mob. They had various popular assemblies. And that was what they called a public thing. And it was much more stable. You know, if you say it ended with the Caesars, it lasted for a good 500 years. So we're only about halfway through. If we can make it as a republic, then we're doing well. And you can tell that our founders wanted that model and not the Athenian model. They were still using the word democracy as direct democracy and the word republic as a representative democracy. They chose it because just look at our government buildings, which are Roman, and the name of the Senate and the name of the hill. The Capitol Hill is the Capitoline Hill in Rome. And above all, let's go to James Madison and Alexander Hamilton. Look at the pen names they used when they had the greatest debate in world history about democracy, which was the debate in 1787 and 88, when they had to decide whether or not to ratify the Constitution, the debate between Federalists and Anti-Federalists. And the Federalists, in the Federalist Papers, which are really, there's some things in this busy life of ours worth taking time out for and reviewing, and it's the Federalist Papers, because everything with their strange vocabulary and spelling that they bring up, they are the topics we're facing in California now. And I'm about to hopefully unravel that for you, but Madison Hamilton and John Jay in the were the Federalists in those in that exchange, and then and they used the pen name Publius. Publius was the first consul of Republican Rome. Their enemies, not to be outdone, used the pen name Brutus or Catus. Brutus was the other consul, and Cato was another famous Republican Roman. Two Catos, older and a younger. So they were really, they were totally clear that in these gestures that it was the Roman ideal, the Republic, not the Athenian, to strive for. And then and nonetheless, the debate between Federalists and Anti-Federalists came down to a debate between representative and direct democracy, because the Anti-Federalists really wanted what they called a participatory democracy, much more decentralized local government, but very direct, a permanent town hall meeting. And it extended to all the other branches. They wanted juries to decide not just fact, but law. They really felt virtue resided with the people, not an elite. And they accused the Federalists of being elitist. You see, that populist-elitist tension also ran all the way back in our history. And of course, you also know that the Federalists, their opponent, you know, the other side, won. And that's the Constitution we have. So how did they win? There were many debates, of course. There was national security, and I don't mean to minimize it or oversimplify it, but let's just take this issue of direct democracy or republic. The Federalists won with the answer republic, and James Madison in particular, with three arguments that are really relevant for us. One is, in a direct democracy, you get sooner or later a tyranny of the majority. Why wouldn't the majority just vote individuals or minorities out of rights? They did it all the time in Athens. Socrates is just the most famous of them. But you know, you always don't like someone, so you vote them out of rights, and got in a bit of hot water in a sort of event like this yesterday when I cited potentially Prop 8 as an example of that. I want to make it clear, you can feel any way you want about the issue of gay marriage. Just try to abstract the principle, which is that a majority goes to the ballot and decides whether a minority, let's say it's left-handed people, should have rights. And the irony there is that actually what reversed it was the courts, and the courts were what Hamilton and Madison thought of, along with the Senate and the original Electoral College, as an element of aristocracy. So they thought of that as one of these branches that the Romans showed us to filter the will of the majority. So number one, tyranny of the majority. However, I think that that's actually not the main issue we're facing in California. So the next two points that Madison raised are more interesting. One of them is what he called that, you know, in direct democracy, the people will vote, will legislate directly. They will do so with passion, out of passion. And he didn't mean that in a good sense, he meant that in a bad sense. So they thought for a long time about how to cool the tempers of the people. And what is passion? Well, passion could be the crime of the week, you know, the week you happen to go to a ballot box, or the person in traffic you're really pissed off at when you get there to the ballot box, or whatever else really bugged you and what the media kicked up. That so you're gonna vote not with a deliberation about long-term causes and analysis and consequences, but with passion. And Madison didn't think that was a good idea. He wanted calm deliberation and analysis of trade-offs, and he thought that a body of representatives with access to information would be better able to do this. An example there, by the way, would be, I think, some of our ballot initiatives on sentencing, tough on crime. So the three strikes law might be one example. Could you reuse it? And you understand, I'm not choosing left or right or anything. I'm just trying to abstract to the principle behind it. But we were angry in the 90s about crime. We wanted to lock them up longer. And thereby, in successive ballot measures, we were allocating the state budget, because prisons have been its fastest growing part And that's because we decided to make it so. It's not that the legislature at some point convened and said, let's make prisons the fastest growing part for the next two decades. It's just that's the consequences if you lock more people up for a lot longer. You could have symmetrically from the opposite side of the ideological spectrum, you could find examples of this there. And then the third point was the most, the one that my favorite, where I think James Madison was most prescient. He used a word of minority factions. And he said, and he was very influenced by Montesquieu, an Enlightenment thinker, and they thought about, you know, the ancient direct democracy in Athens, and even in Rome, the Republic, they were three things: small, homogeneous, and virtuous. But what we're trying to do is we're trying to have a nation here that'll be very large, very diverse, and the virtue was up in the air. And so how do you work that? And he realized that minority factions would seize the processes of democracy, and minority factions is what we call special interests. So he built the structure of the federal constitution, so hoping that they would contain one another so that the society would not suffer too much and would stay free, because the minority factions, the special interests, would almost cancel each other out. And what happened in California is that the minority factions, or the special interests, did in fact seize the process of direct democracy. And you just look at, so let's say those special interests are the, for instance, the unions, the teachers union or the prisons guard union, but also every other special interest, from pot smokers to greens and so forth. The way to do anything, California, for the last 30 years has been to bankroll an initiative. That's the way to do it. So the way our system, and I'm going to try to talk more about how the Californian system has evolved, but has just for the last few decades, but not before that, work is that the minority factions literally go to war with each other, and of course we have the role of money in the process and so forth. So really, I think that Madison would have, this is Madison's worst nightmare. This is what he predicted, he'd feel justified, and at the same time, you know, he'd be sad about it. And so Madison and Montesquieu, they were for three branches of government to check each other: executive, judiciary, legislative. And then, and that really served the nation quite well, until suddenly a bunch of states in the West, a good century after Madison, added a fourth branch, which was the branch that Madison didn't want there. With the fourth branch is the direct democracy, because that's what it is. It's really a fourth branch. So how and why might that have happened? And it's a circuitous tale, but it's just good trivia. Where did this come from in California? And it came from Switzerland. And the irony there is that the Swiss, which have cantons, just like the American states almost, they were in a very similar situations in about 1850, after some civil war and revolution, that America had been in during the time of Madison, and they needed a good federal constitution to hold it together, so they took the American Constitution. However, they had since the Middle Ages, 13th century or so, their own tradition of direct democracy. Not necessarily descending from Athens, but what they had is these alpine valleys. They governed themselves, and they often sent people the hard journey across it to another valley and said, "Shall we build a road together, you and us, the villages?" And then when they agreed something, the agreement had to be carried back. And that's ad referendum in Latin. So they had the referendum. Everything had to be carried back, literally in a backpack, and then in an assembly, as in Athens, was voted on. And so the Swiss had been practicing at the local level for many hundreds of years, this direct democracy, and of course the Swiss were then and still are Swiss. I almost went to graduate school in Switzerland once, and they're very different than Californians, should we say. I would say. So there's always, you can always keep in the back of your mind, any democracy, just as capitalism, any flavor of it, as is rooted in a culture, and Swiss culture is a strong culture, and so are we. And so you can have the same tools and they'll have different outcomes in different cultures. But anyway, so the Swiss had this tradition, they didn't want to get rid of it, so they made that federal too. So that was the tweak on their Madisonian constitution imported from us. And from the start, given this cultural background, both the processes and the usage of direct democracy in Switzerland was to fit what they wanted it to do, which was to help people achieve compromise and consensus. It was to actually help minority factions, special interests in Switzerland, come together. That's how they use it, which is very interesting. The federal chancellor of Switzerland was at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco last year, and I actually really liked her speech and then followed up with her and stuff about the transcript and explained this, that in Switzerland, direct democracy brings special interests together. And there are various technical ways in which this is done that we can discuss if we want to later during the debate here talk about reform efforts, whether we could have the same. But the interesting thing is that of course, in California, we today have the exact opposite cultural purpose of the same tools, which is confrontation. And so actually, the interesting thing is, where did that come from? Is that just our, you know, if a Swiss person, I live in LA now, you know, rides in a car on Wilshire Avenue, it's entirely clear where the confrontation comes from. But I think even the historical origin is clear, because the reason we brought it in from Switzerland was when we were a young state and very empty, and actually not very well connected, the thing that connected it was a railroad, the Southern Pacific Railroad, and it controlled all the political, the legislators, the mayors, all parts of our fledgling, emerging governance, and there was enormous corruption. Basically, this railroad dominated everything, and so the progressive movement, which was a national thing, they were for women's suffrage all over America, and for direct election of the U.S. senators, which started with them. But here in California, especially under Governor Hiram Johnson, with help from Swiss expatriates, they focused on direct democracy as a tool, as a weapon against the Southern Pacific Railroad. So they went to Switzerland, studied it, brought it back, and said, we'll take these three tools, recall, referendum, and initiative, to attack you, the railroad, if you don't start behaving. And so they brought it in, but Hiram Johnson, even then, and this was exactly 100 years ago, so it's a bit of an anniversary this year, said, this is meant as a safety valve. Only when, as now, and only if and when we think there's corruption in our representative democracy, then we'll go around them. And as the Southern Pacific Railroad sort of faded from power naturally, during the 1900s, and more immigrants came, and California grew and prospered, and so forth. These tools really were used as a safety valve, and I know David studied ballot measures going back to the 20s at one point, as we were discussing earlier, but there weren't that many on the ballot. So we didn't, they weren't, our first resort. And those were the years, without any intention of being nostalgic, but the other cultural factors, we were rather small and homogenous, as they used to say. I should be winding up, is that right? Conspired that the legislature, the representative arm, was actually quite functional, not yet dysfunctional, and the system wasn't used yet. When did it mutate? So it really slumbered. It was this confrontational tool that slumbered for a long time, and then woke up. And it woke up, and at this point, you can take the narrative from your own living memory, because I think that was about the 1970s, and specifically 1978 with Prop 13. And I'm not terribly interested, for our purposes, in the property tax aspect of it, although there were unintended consequences that are interesting to study, because I think all ballot measures tend to have unintended consequences, which is why Madison wanted elected representatives studying them and ruminating on them and trying to figure out what the unintended consequences might be, and Prop 13 had those. But more interesting is the cultural impact, because Howard Jarvis, the sponsor, became so famous that everyone with an ego in California and with money sat up and said, I want to do this too. And all the minority factions that Madison had worried about also sat up and said, hey, that's the thing we're going to do. And then they started doing it. And then you had literally every decade more and more ballot measures. And since then, we've had hundreds. And progressively, all these measures, as I was hinting at earlier, allocated the budget that we usually now blame the legislature for not solving. And I'm not, and this is a good segue to where we can start the discussion, because we had this discussion before I came in. I'm not suggesting that the legislature is not at fault, but I want to put it to you in a conundrum or a question or a dilemma to ponder, which is which caused which, or whose chicken, whose egg. Did the voters kind of go nuts progressively in the last three decades and pass all these laws that in effect allocated the budget and that constrained the legislature with term limits and with everything because the voters are so angry at these incompetent legislators? So did the voters in effect make them incompetent, or did the legislature somehow first become incompetent and therefore require the voters to do it themselves at the ballot box? So you have a chicken and egg, and we could be talking about this all night. And it's an interesting discussion, because if you're going to reform this, you have to fix both, at least those two puzzles, and I would argue the executive branch as well. If you're going to fix one and not the other, our legislative branch was split in two, voters and legislators, so we have to fix them together. That's where I would, where we'd end and throw it open to questions. So thank you for listening.
I've got a couple of my own questions. I don't know, I'll hold them off. There's one person here who I think really nailed it. He or she said, what are the three things you would do right now to get us out of this dysfunctionality? And I think, short things, not, elaborate.
Oh, short things. Well,
Oh,
you mean short in terms of
time,
articulation?
More short things in terms of...
So you want the bumper sticker because we're...
Well, we're Californians.
I mean, all the short-term things are short-term. We have a recession. We're coming out of it. And usually in California, that takes care of everything because we have a tax system that amplifies ups and downs. So every time we come out of a recession, we're swimming in it for a while. That's usually not a good thing because we're not responsible with that, the money we then get. But some of the dire economic circumstances could take care of themselves in the short term. Then we have the very short-term problem with our budget right now. So if we could talk tactics in terms of Jerry Brown and whether he should put tax extensions on a ballot, whether he can, whether it could be an all-cuts budget. Those are short-term things. Mm-hmm. But in the context of this, remember, I set out to chronicle underlying causes that will be here next time the tide goes out. Are we still going to be naked then? So if you're talking about governance again, which is my focus in the report, then it can't be that short term, although I know there are short term ballot measures, ironically, in the works from reform committees, such as the Think Long Committee for California, which is fairly new, starting next year and then rolled out. As you remember, last year we had a talk about a constitutional convention. And that died because they tried to put it on a ballot, and it died for lack of money because special interests were boycotting it. I went to collect signatures with them. It was very interesting. Anyway, we're not having a constitutional convention. That wouldn't have been that short term either, because those things take a few years, and then you ratify it, and just as with the Federalist, Anti-Federalist debate. And the other thing I would say is just it can't be short term. It took about three decades to get into this mess, so we're lucky if we can take a decade to get out of it. But if you're going to ask just what are the best things, well, this gets very wonky. I have a laundry list of possible reforms. And by the way, I'm a journalist. I talk to experts and analyze what they say. I don't want to want you to think that I'm pretending that this comes from me. But one thing is there's some nuance in the three tools of direct democracy. It's very interesting that most other countries use referendums a lot and have never really heard of the initiative. And we make it quite difficult to use referendums and very easy to use initiatives, even initiatives to change our constitution, which is why we have 500 amendments in ours, which is a century younger than the American, which has 24. Is it 24? But you see, we constantly amend our constitution because it's easy. So think for a moment, if you're going to change nothing else except You make referendums easy and initiatives hard, you've already won. If all the ballot measures we'd had in the last 30 years had been referendums, we probably wouldn't be in this mess. And why is that? That's because in a referendum, you get to vote up or down on something your legislature did. So you hold it to account. You hold Madison's representative to account. And you can say, no, we don't like that, but you send it back to them and they have to re-deliberate and send you something else. Whereas an initiative directly circumvents them. So you make laws, which are actually in California, and which is in a unique aspect, no other state or country has this aspect, the laws, statute, or constitutional amendment you make at the ballot box here are of a higher class than the laws the legislature makes. The legislature, in other words, cannot repeal, amend any ballot measure, whereas all the other states have mechanisms for that. So for example, term limits. Following the Californian example, Idaho also voted in at the ballot box term limits, then discovered unintended consequences, and then the legislature repealed it. So there are mechanisms like this that exist. So I'm simply saying if you were to change one thing, why not have more referendums? In other words, if you can't stop going to the ballot box altogether, which I think would be a great idea, but if we're not going to do that, I think there's no chance of that in California. Let's just do more referendums. And then there's other reforms following from that. I mean, you know, just sort of fewer initiatives, make them clearer, make them shorter, make more people understand them, make them say what they will cost, what tax would have to be raised, or what other program would have to be cut, and try not to undercut the legislature, but try to, like, create a conversation as they do in Switzerland.
Okay, I have two questions here that I'm going to pull from the cards that came in. Chicken egg. Let's go back to your chicken egg example. And let me throw in a little chicken feed here to give you an example. Let's take Prop 13. Let's go back to 1978. This was a proposition that stemmed from the fact that at that point in time, Sacramento had already become dysfunctional. It could not come to grips with the fact that we had an escalating real estate base for our local tax system. It did not know what to do, or if it did, it couldn't bring itself to do. Reagan tried to do something. There were other initiatives. So there's an example where had the legislature acted and done something to put a cap on the rate at which the property tax assessments were increasing, we might not have had Prop 13. My favorite example, however, is, and this is, I'm going to add this to the questioner's example, was the Coastal Commission. The Coastal Commission was a direct result of the inability of the state legislature to come to grips with the fact that if we built high-rise buildings all the way up and down the coast of California, it probably wouldn't be good for the state. And they kind of debated that. They knew that was the issue to deal with, but they were in paralysis over that issue. A group of sort of, if you excuse the phrase, do-gooding people said, we've got to do something about this. Let's go to the initiative. And by doing so, they basically passed a constitutional amendment that made the Coastal Commission inviolate in terms of trying to change it. You can change a constitutional amendment, which most initiatives are, with 66% with supermajority, but it's obviously tough to do that. So that the question is, Prop 13, Coastal Commission, and I'm sure there are many others, isn't it dysfunctionality in Sacramento that leads to the mob?
So it is the chicken and egg debate.
Well, I don't know who's the chicken and who the egg here, but
it's which caused which, or
I would say that Sacramento is the chicken and the egg is the initiative.
Well, so let's take Prop 13, and is Prop 13 so famous that one no longer needs to summarize what it was?
I think people in this room know Prop 13. Right?
Because I have a chapter in my survey, which is about how much Californian voters think they know and how much they know, and it specifically found that the people who are more educated, older, better off, know less and specifically misunderstand Prop 13. That was
Right.
An interesting informational infrastructure discovery. You know, this was based on data from PPIC,
right,
which you founded, David. So actually, I think it's not to be taken for granted that everyone understands Prop 13, although it is certainly clear that everyone is convinced that they understand it. But so the chicken and egg, absolutely, Prop 13 was in the 1970s with the Southern Pacific Railroad, was at the beginning of that century, which was the focus of anger. This is the perceived failure. We need to go around it. What might have happened, what might Madison or Hamilton say is, well, first of all, a bunch of governors and legislators trying and failing to address the rise in property taxes. What does that mean? Well, why don't you Californians vote them out? So, and replace them with representatives who understand. Why don't you make your representatives understand that they have to deal with this and then let them deal with it properly in a way that would not, the main unintended consequence of Prop 13 was to centralize all financing in California in a way that would not have that side effect. And then you can answer, maybe gerrymandering was already around in the primary system, and so there was maybe a flaw in the legislative branch, so therefore that must be fixed. Unfortunately, we may have started fixing that. But you see, we could have focused on the legislators and the governor, because we do, in a Madison or Republican, every few years get to vote. So let's put in people who understand. And I think it might have been fixed, because that's what the whole state was talking about. By circumventing it, we then fixed that by immediately creating new problems that were unintended and enshrining it in the firmament, mm-hmm, and then building everything on top of it, and then starting all the other ballot measures, such as Prop 98 about education, which tried to reverse its effect by, you know, you limited the financing of school districts, so now you have to, with Prop 98, have a new ballot measure to re-enshrine that spending, and then to, and so forth. So my preference would have been to, you know, vote for a different legislator and a different governor and then let them fix it.
Do you think, one of the questions here is, do you think it's, once the genie is now out of the bottle, the special interest genie, which goes back to presumably your Greek example and certainly back to Madison, how can we put the genie back in the bottle?
Greeks actually didn't have special interests yet. They didn't have parties yet. That was a tyranny of the majority. The minority factions arise in a large and diverse society, of which we're the best example, because we're the most diverse state. Can we put the genie of minority factions back in the bottle? Well, By the way, I'm a journalist, and my focus in life is to tell you stories in a way that keeps you reading so that you learn and enjoy it. I'm not under any obligation to provide answers. That is someone else's job. I just want to make that clear.
Why are we here?
We're here because to tell a good story and to understand the problem, which I find interesting, because I have to tell you, I have lots of opinions, and I disagree with each and every one of them at any given time. So please take this with a, you know, I'm much humbler about these opinions than you think, maybe. But sorry, remind me of where we were at that point. Oh yes, can we put the genie back in the bottle? It reminds me of the Constitutional Convention debate we had last year.
Right.
There were many arguments against it, and then a banal reason why it failed. But one of the main arguments against it was the same freak show will show up in the room that we now have with the ballot initiative process. You could call a constitutional convention, and you're hoping to get Philadelphia in 1787, the August Mines, I think 54 of them. Instead, you get the teachers' union, the prison guards' union, and all the rest of them, and they show up, and they now write the Constitution. So, you know, when they're in the room, exactly what, how can you put the genie back in the bottle if we have splintered into minority factions? I just don't know. But during this week and in other debates I've had, at this point people sometimes suggest that you decentralize power again, so that if we're so diverse and we have self-selected by moving to, you know, places where everyone agrees with us and dresses like us, and we, you know, if you devolve power to a local government more, then we can make decisions that way. We don't all have to agree, you know. I don't know what the answer is. I'd be curious what you think.
Well, we have one questioner who says, should we really finally divide the state in two?
Well, why two?
North and South. Well, you know, this has been around. This is actually a very serious proposal.
No, the North and South is very outdated. The North and South goes back to the time of Hiram Johnson.
Right.
And the water wars, you know, one half has water when the other wants it. But now it's really inland and coastal, or, you know, we were talking about this
right.
Demographically. It's Central Valley. And in fact, there is an effort underway that I wrote about a year and a half ago or so. In the Central Valley, they want to secede. They want to have two states. So I also wrote about a similar effort in Arizona, where they want to split off Pima County in the south from what they consider the crazies in Maricopa County. So it's sort of like an American tradition. You always want to split off from somebody. But actually, only Maine has split from Massachusetts and West Virginia from Virginia. So we're not going to split off, I think. And also, by the way, think of, it would depend on Congress. You'd get two more senators. What would they be? So one party would, you know, if you create the red California, there would be two red ones. And so depending on who's in power in Washington, that just wouldn't fly.
I have a questioner here who said, California has always been a sort of prediction of where the nation is going. Didn't we just, in effect, predict what's happened in Washington? That when you look at Washington today, it's indistinguishable from Sacramento. We don't have the initiative at the nationwide level, and probably won't have, but the paralysis is at the governance, at the representative level, not the initiative level. Perhaps that then reflects on the same problem facing California, which is we can't reach closure at the point where we have our elected officials.
Well, I thought you were going to say what you told me earlier, that great quote by Peter Schrag, that California had its Tea Party 30 years before the rest of the country,
right.
And it was in 1978, and therefore, if you've been having the Tea Party all along, why you don't need to do it now, and therefore they didn't do it last November. But in that sense, I mean, the problem of partisanship, or hyper-partisan extremism, is clearly it may be intertwined, but certainly, you know, supersedes the debate about direct democracy. Madison's answer would be, they didn't have parties yet when they wrote the Constitution. Those developed in the decade after. But he said that he would just consider those minority factions, bring them into the structure. But something clearly happened in the country and the state that to make everything more partisan. And it must be more than just gerrymandering in the primary process. And I'm fascinated by it, and I don't know that I'm sociologically I understand it.
There have been two periods in one key period in American history when there has been less partisanship, and that's pretty much from the beginning to end of World War II and then through the Cold War. Prior to that, we were a nation divided, and to a certain extent, we've become a nation divided in the aftermath of the end of the Cold War. To what extent do you think this is at the core of our country that we have we have powerful differences of opinions? Certainly, I can trace my family back to the Mason-Dixon line, and those on one side of the line had one attitude, and one on the other side had the other attitude, and there was just no way of reaching
closure. So the task or the mandate is then to prevent the Civil War again.
Well, there is.
Because it's one thing to say it's always been there, and then, you know, occasionally it kills a large percentage of Americans.
Well, we have, what I'm really sort of want to get back to is you started out by talking about the direct democracy creating a dysfunctionality,
mm-hmm.
and then you link that dysfunctionality to the bond rating that we get from Standard & Poor's and so forth from a AAA
mm-hmm.
during Jerry Brown's first administration to a minus A today. And I'm trying to come to grips with, as you talk, the degree to which there's a causality there as against a coincidence of
forces.
Well,
that's a sort of tighter framing of it.
The causality, we can also debate, but the legislature certainly has to pass budgets, and until last year, we required 2/3 majority, which we opposed also through the initiative process, and we were the only state that had another 2/3 majority to raise revenues. So we made it intentionally hard for the legislature to do it by letting every no vote on a budget count double every yes vote. So somehow voters wanted to double the power of the minority party, which is an interesting thought process if you think about it. By requiring a 2/3 majority, you're saying I want the minority party to double in power. And on top of that, there's the issue of ballot box budgeting. And I've been asking, this is one of my hobbies, to ask everyone, and I want your opinion too, on how much of the California budget that the legislature is expected to balance, at least on paper every year, is already allocated when they start negotiating by the hundreds of ballot initiatives that exist. Prisons are an example, or the environmental laws and so forth. And I've received sort of answers between 70% and 90%. So it's interesting, it's sort of a little bit similar to the federal budget where, you know, we all know it's Medicare and Medicaid and a bit of Social Security and then defense, and then we're supposed to balance it by just talking about what's left over. Well, the legislature in California is also just balancing, working with what's left over after all the ballot box budgeting, except no voter understands this or actually then turns it around and says, well, I, the voter, I've been voting for this all along, therefore we have these commitments to these programs that we put in place. But now I have the right to get angry at the legislature for not balancing it by finding the other 10%. So on the other hand, as I said, through the partisan deadlock and by the 2/3 requirement, it made sense for the minority party to just block because they can't. Because they knew, I think, that the state would blame either the majority party. That fits on a bumper sticker, right? Who's in control of the legislature? It's the Democrats. So if the minority party blocks it, they can legitimately blame it on the Democrat, on the majority party. And of course, the majority party says, well, it's not our fault because you, the voters, double the power of the minority party. And so no one is accountable. And that's another sort of upshot of excessive direct democracy, is that democracy usually is supposed to lead to accountability, and it does the opposite in our case. So I guess that's a lot of thoughts, but I think that explains the chronic inability to have timely budgets, and the budget issues are the main reason why Standard & Poor's and Moody's think we're the worst credit risk, which is quite silly because the bonds will still get paid if you look at the constitutionality of the order of payments, but that's not,
Okay, we have time for one last question, and I think we should sort of basically focus on again, idea. You've now studied a great deal about California. You've brought a lot to the table in your report. I will commend everybody here to read this. This is really a terrific summary of what our history is. You bring in all the Greek and historical references, which is terrific. Is there any tax reform is there any light at the end of the tunnel? I pressed you on this with the three examples, but you've now had a chance to look at us as almost as a sociologist looking or political scientist looking at this phenomenal state with size and diversity and beauty and so forth. If you were to stand back and say what single thing you would recommend we do as a state, what would it be?
You're demanding, by rights, the silver bullet, and I refuse to give you one because I don't think it exists. Well, and I'd be vulgarizing the whole thing by saying, here's the thing, and I've discovered it. We have a governance problem, and as you pointed out, and as I agree with before we came in here, California has all these strengths, and they're saving it. They're going to save it again because the recession does seem to be over, and then there'll be another one at some point. But there's these innovation engines, especially Silicon Valley. but also others, and the small business and the diverse economy and the entrepreneurial spirit and the quality of life that still draws talent here. So that stuff hasn't gone away just because the governance has failed. And if the economy picks up again, well, that's an immediate boost because we have this tax system that we need to reform for this purpose. It's too complex. But it is very volatile. And volatility is great on the upswing because there's going to be a lot of money coming in soon. And we'll get, you know, hopefully we'll create a rainy day fund and we'll do some of the things that are responsible with it. So that'll be the silver bullet. It's actually, it was an external shock and there'll be the external savior of the economy, probably. And let's hope there's no earthquake and things like that. And then for the governance reform, which is important because we still have problems, and governance is as important as can you deal with your problems. Prisons and public pensions and mediocre schools and so forth. But you notice those problems are all shared by everyone else, but we can't deal with it. And for those things, you need a lot of reforms and not just a silver bullet. And I think they'll come because I know they're in the works. I've even talked to the people drafting them. And that's why I think, I don't know about optimism is not really, optimism or pessimism is not something I'm interested in taking a stance on, but it'll be very interesting to live in California. Because, as you know, I conclude with, I think the great debate between federalists and anti-federalists is a historic debate. They're studying that all over the world because they raised every issue. And I have a feeling we're going to have the same debate just as good again in the next couple of years as these reform efforts come. And so right now we're talking about it in one room, but I think the whole state's going to be talking about this. And that's great and just interesting.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. I'm getting signals from the back of the room. So on behalf of the World Affairs Council of Northern California, I would like to thank Andreas Kluth for his evening, for his comments, and for providing us with his thoughts and insights. Many thanks to the audience for coming.
Thank you.
Let me make my pitch one more time.